Our next speaker is Matthew Butler. He's a historian and associate professor of history at the University of Texas at Austin. He's he is responsible for many books. He's an expert on Mexico, the Cristero War, and lately he's been researching Mexican bullfighting, which is sounds to me like a fascinating topic. And he's made, to my mind, some wonderful discoveries about the whiskey priests, which he will tell us about in a second. I'm particularly grateful to him because when I was working in an amateurish way writing about Mexico, he helped me a huge amount, and he's part of a new wave of historians dealing with Mexico in the last 20 or so years who've completely revamped our understanding of what happened in Mexico, say, between 1920 and 1940, 1900 and 1940. Anyway, I won't be pedantic. I'll give you Matthew Butler.
Well, thank you very much, Richard, and good morning, everyone. If you were expecting a Texan accent, because I'm from UT Austin, can't oblige, unfortunately. So this morning, I would like to start by thanking the organizers of this festival, especially Richard, for your welcome, your free invitation, for the long line of emails that we've been exchanging over the past 4 or 5 years before meeting today. I'm going to talk today more really about the historical substratum of one of Green's books, especially The Power and the Glory, though I'll talk about The Lawless Roads and other things as well. Unlike Kevin's talk, it's more really a question of art imitating life, since I hope to tell you things you probably don't know about the whiskey priest, and also about Green's time in Mexico. We hear often that Green had a miserable time in Mexico, and he writes this in many places, but again, hearing Kevin's talk this morning, I think Green might have been more contented by the political ramifications of his visit to Mexico and its significance. Anyway, I'll start from the very beginning. So, in the parish of Huango, on the 12th day of the month of March, 1886, I, Father Ramon E. Lemus, priest with the cure of souls in this parish, exorcised, applied holy oil, baptized, and anointed with holy chrism, a child who was born in this town on the 10th day. I named him José Macario Gregorio de Guadalupe, legitimate son of Don Jesús Fernández Aguado and Doña Ramona Villicaña. And then he signs off as parish priest. And this is how the real whiskey priest enters the record, not as the small man dressed in a shabby dark city suit and carrying an attaché case, as in The Power and the Glory, but a screaming newborn hundreds of miles from Tabasco in the Michoacán Highlands in 1886, which is 15 years before Green's birth. It's appropriate that the inspiration for Green's ecclesiastical anti-hero, Macario Fernández Aguado, took some tracking down. Unusually for Mexico, where it's common to take a paternal and then a maternal surname, Macario took both patronymics, the surname of his father and his father's mother. He didn't take his mother's last name, Villicaña, which complicated the search for him and made him hard to track down in ancestral terms. Maybe that's because his mother died when he was 8 years old, but we know it's him. A handwritten note in the parish book says that the person who received baptism 272 was later ordained a priest in the diocese of Tabasco in the year ... and then no year is given, adding to the air of dilapidated mystery that enshrouds the whiskey priest in The Power and the Glory. As you'll know, an identity on paper or the lack of it plays a key role in the novel. The devil of it is we haven't photographs, says the lieutenant in one point. All he has is a faded newspaper article that he carries on his saddle pommel. The whiskey priest's only record of his own priesthood is a pencil-written speech that he wrote for the anniversary of one of his ordinations. He guards it jealously from the mestizo, who says at one point, "What's that paper, Father?" Without paper, the priest's identity is fluid, and a Judas, the mestizo, is required to expose him. So Green teases us with the idea that his ecclesiastical muse is undocumented. He doesn't give his character a name, and nor does he reveal his historical source in any of his other writings, not in The Lawless Roads, not in his diary, and not in his autobiographies. The truth of the matter is that the real whiskey priest, Father Macario, was no mystery. At least, I suspect, not a mystery to Green himself. In fact, Father Macario left a rich and fascinating correspondence of his life in the historical archive of the Archdiocese of Mexico in Mexico City. It contains scores of letters that he sent to his bishop, Pascual Diaz. He sent to his bishop, Pascual Diaz, in the 1920s and 1930s. This is Diaz. I sometimes wonder if Diaz is the inspiration for Green's description of the whiskey priest, the fat and youngish priest who stood with one plump hand splayed authoritatively out. He seems to fit the bill, if nothing else. Diaz was in New York, so it's obvious that Father Macario was part of a kind of an international network, and he played an important role in that. The letters contain vivid accounts of Macario's life as a fugitive priest. They contain some newspaper articles denouncing the religious situation in Tabasco that he published under a pseudonym in Mexico City. Most of the letters are typed or written in a hurry, often al fresco or in some shack in Tabasco with the monsoon rains dripping in through the roof. They were then sent to Villahermosa, Tabasco state capital, to a man called Dr. Fernando Maldonado and his son Fernandito, little Fernando. Fernandito worked for the Banco de Mexico, the national bank, and as such, he could arrange discreet wire transfers to Diaz of all the parish fees that Macario earned in Tabasco, which were sent to New York so that Diaz could continue to educate seminarians for Tabasco in that place. Macario sent all his letters by courier to Villahermosa. By courier, I mean any mule driver, any peasant, any trader who happened to be going through the rancheria, the hamlet where Macario was staying, and then on to Villahermosa. So we know that he put his hand scores, perhaps hundreds of times, he's put his life in the hands of many, many strangers. And these good Samaritans took very compromising letters, sums of money that would have been temptingly large to them, all the way to Villahermosa at real personal risk and without taking a cent. If they hadn't done so, I wouldn't be standing here now, and Macario would be just as Green left him, a psychologically complex soul, but still a character. In the next 30, 40 minutes or so, I want to introduce you to the real Macario. And from now on, to avoid confusion, I will talk about Macario when I talk about the priest, and I will talk about the whiskey priest when I talk exclusively about the fictional character. Much of what Green wrote is historically as well as poetically true. Macario was the last priest left in the godless, dry state of Tabasco. He was a confirmed alcoholic, though I doubt that he drank whiskey. Whiskey would have been very expensive. Much more likely he drank aguardiente, the Mexican sugarcane rum. Pascual Diaz, his bishop, did consider him a sort of saint, and the whole book, as you know, is about a sort of saint. On the other hand, Green also embellishes. There is no evidence that Macario ever fathered a child, although enough Mexican priests did. And unlike the whiskey priest, Macario was not martyred by a Mexican revolutionary firing squad. There, Green has really retrofitted the story of martyr priests such as Father Pro, the more militant priests who were mixed up in the Catholic resistance against the Mexican Revolution. Instead, I can tell you that Macario lived until 1951, long enough in theory to have read Green's book for himself. The first Spanish edition was published in 1944. A final paradox is that Macario's own martyrdom came much later and at the hands of Mexican Catholic priests in a struggle over the memory of the religious persecution in Tabasco. Macario was associated with men who were held to have betrayed the church in Mexico, and he was shunned. For the same reason, he is almost as unknown in Mexico as he is here. For the same reason, perhaps, El Poder y la Gloria is much less read in Mexico than The Power and the Glory is read here or in the United States. I appreciate that I'm in a room full of Green fans, not Mexicanist historians, so I'm hoping that by meeting Macario, we'll also learn new things about Green and about his time in Mexico in 1938, which is a lot more involved politically than I think he often let on. I also think that Green knew an awful lot about Macario. Suggestive coincidences between Macario's letters and The Power and the Glory make me strongly suspect that Green once read the same clandestine correspondence that I have. I had the strange sensation that Green was breathing down my neck as I was reading through all of the correspondence in the archives. More than that, I suspect that Green met Father Macario in the flesh in his week-long visit to Tabasco in 1938. I can't prove this, it's not written down anywhere, But I think I can show that Green had, one, the opportunity, and two, the means to have met Macario. Obviously, he had a motive, which was to write his ecclesiastical manhunt novel. All he really needed was curiosity and enough nerve to find his muse. And I think we read in Richard's biography that nerve was, and temerity and devilry were things that Green certainly did not lack. In the rest of this talk, I want to do three things. First, I'll give a quick biographical sketch about Macario and some brief but necessary background about religious situations in revolutionary Tabasco. Then I want to present some of the Macario letters that he sent to Diaz. They don't cover the whole persecution period, which is really 1914 to about 1936, 1938, but they cover the essential years from 1926 to 1933, which were the years of the Cristero War, Catholic peasants fighting against the Mexican Revolution, and the worst of the persecutions in Tabasco. I want to talk about four themes. One is persecution. The second theme is libations, the liquids of the gods. So I'm talking about communion wine, but also the holy oils. There are three holy oils in the Catholic Church that you apply to people at baptism and death, and Macario writes a lot about those. The third theme is indigenous Catholics, the people that Macario was ministering to. And the fourth theme is sainthood, and I will try and draw out some resemblances that I think might interest you between the Macario letters and The Power and the Glory as we now have it. Bean-counting academic historians love to chide filmmakers and novelists about their mistakes and inaccuracies, but Green made his mistakes, but he got things startlingly correct in historical terms, I think. It's another reason I think he read the letters, and it's another reason why we still read The Power and the Glory and find it so compelling 83 years on. The third and last section of the talk is going to be about Green and the time that he spent among Mexican Catholics. It's important to understand from the beginning that Green did not meet random or generic Mexican Catholics. When we look very closely at the people he met, as he describes in The Lawless Rose in his diary, we can see that he was steered towards a particular type of Catholic, to Catholics of a certain political persuasion. Green used these figures to research his book, but he also allowed himself, I think, to be gently used by them. So first of all, who was Macario? Well, he wasn't a Tabasqueño. He's not from Tabasco. He's from Michoacán, a highland state in western Mexico. His family were probably farmers, rancheros. They had enough money to send him to the seminary, but not until the comparatively late age of 17. He goes there in 1903. He ends up in Tabasco in 1905. That's really because the Bishop of Tabasco comes through Michoacán, recruiting priests to take back home to his diocese in the Gulf lowlands. Tabasco is a much less Catholic place than Michoacán. Macario receives his holy orders on March 28, 1911, after the standard eight-year training. So to me, that suggests he's not brilliant enough to be fast-tracked, but there are no problems with the drinking or anything like that holding him back at that particular point. And henceforth, he spent basically the rest of his life in Tabasco, except for three periods. One was the Mexican Revolution, when he went back to Michoacán, the 1910s and early 20s. One was the period 1935 to 1938, when, in fact, Macario was deported to Guatemala. He was expelled from Tabasco and ends up in Guatemala. And then the last 4 years of his life, 1947 to 1951, he was basically kicking around dead-end parishes around Mexico City in the Valley of Mexico, hoping to get back to Tabasco. It was too cold, too unfriendly for him to live there. But he didn't manage it, and he died in obscurity in 1951 in Mexico State. Before the persecutions, Macario was... he was priest in the parish of Nacajuca, which is kind of in the middle of that map that I can show you there from Tabasco. It's a 1910s 1920s map. As you can see, that Tabasco itself is a lowland, low-lying Gulf state. It was a backwater really in the 1920s and the 1930s, and except for the southern area. So this area down here. Except for the southern area, it's basically a flat plain covered with lagoons that become swampy in the dry season. It had a very small population. The whole state population was 220,000 people or thereabouts. The population of Villahermosa, which was the capital, was only 15,000 or 16,000 people. So when Makaru and when the whiskey priest talk about their constant fear of being exposed and discovered, they are really talking, you know, about an actual reality. Most people in Tabasco are Catholic, 87% of them, but only 9% of them married in church. It's a remarkably Catholic place superficially, but the church in Tabasco is really rather weak, actually. The Diocese of Tabasco was created in 1880, so only 30 or 40 or 50 years before the time of the whiskey priest persecution and a little bit before Green goes there. There were just five parishes, and one of those parishes was in the next-door state of Chiapas. That's very important in the novel because the whiskey priest goes from Tabasco to Chiapas. It was very important in the life of Macario as well. There was a parish in the Sea of Tabasco that was not in the state of Tabasco, so it couldn't be governed, it couldn't be got at by the authority in Tabasco. And what an authority it was in Tabasco. This is the time of the government of Tomás Garrido Canabal, who we hear mentioned at various points in the book. He was a Chiapanecan himself. He dominates Tabasco really for a decade and a half, from the 1920s into the 1930s. Very famously under his government, Tabasco became known as the laboratory of the revolution, el laboratorio de la revolución. Really what that means is it was a socialist banana republic, essentially. There was a political arm, as you can see. There was an organization called the Central Resistance League, which we hear about in the book in their acronym as the Red Shirts. They were church-smashing, pro-Garrido bully boys and girls, as well, as you can see at the bottom of the page. They were utilized to kind of consolidate the state's control over the local peasantry. Garrido was very interested in establishing good relations with the Standard Fruit Company, and he provided client labor to Standard Fruit in exchange for kickbacks and for money for infrastructure and for roads and things like that. And that's really where the campesinos fitted in. As part of the campaign, the cultural transformation in Tabasco, there was a tremendous attack on the Catholic Church, like nowhere else in Tabasco. Garrido had a visiting card in which he said he was the personal enemy of God. He named one of his children Lucifer. There are all these kinds of crazy anti-religious excesses, as you can see from the slide there. They used to pull churches down brick by brick, turn them into rationalist schools. There was a phenomenon known as the Quema Santos, the saint burnings. They would drag Catholic saints out of churches and homes, and they would set fire to them and chop them up with axes in these ceremonial scenes, as you can see. This is a film, by the way. It's got this like, little circular feeling that you're being incorporated into the movie yourself if you watch it, and then we set fire to the icon. So an attempt to extirpate religion entirely and to drive it out of the consciences of Catholic Tabasqueños and to insert a cult of reason and a cult of the revolution into people's minds. Well, let me get finally to the letters, to Macario's letters. Again, I'm afraid I don't have a picture to show you, but I can show you a signature. That's the best I can do. There is no photo that I have of Macario, but there is his signature. And I'll talk about the first statement of religious persecution. And in The Power and the Glory, obviously, the lieutenant's pursuit of the whiskey priest reads like something out of the 39 steps. The whiskey priest is a kind of an ecclesiastical Richard Hannay. But compare the novel to a letter, for example, written by Macario to Bishop Diaz in January 1927, which is just as the religious persecutions in Mexico reached a new level of intensity during the Cristero War. Macario writes that he was living 6 leagues distant from Villahermosa in some mysterious little village, and he reports how in November 1926 the police arrived in underground mass. And he writes, "With the apparent objective of making me flee without taking my belongings, there came to Sabina 10 policemen armed with rifles to arrest me because I was accused of being a seditious propagandist. Shortly before they arrived at the house in which I was administering baptism to a regular number of criaturas, babies, somebody warned me, and without finishing, I told the interested parties that once the danger had passed, I would send word and their business would be concluded." There are lots of accounts of these sudden breakups of religious underground gatherings by the Mexican police, and it's remarkably like the accounts that we have in the Power and the Glory. All of the tropes are there: the household masses, the police angling for bribes, the dissimulation, the government sometimes telling Catholics when there will be a search so they can get out of the way, the smuggling of chalices and religious paraphernalia. These are the kinds of things that Macari would have been carrying around. So in the book, he talks about things like an altar stone. That's an altar stone there from a Mexican priest from the 1920s to the 1930s. The chalices and all of the gear that would have been utilized in Catholic are all being bundled up and carried off in a panic. Some of the other interesting things about these letters are the way that they reveal Macario support networks, and we find evidence of that kind of recurring in The Power and the Glory as well. For example, we have the Fellows family from England who appear at various moments in the novel. In the same letter I've just quoted, Macario reports that his real helpers were someone called Professor Guillermo Eskildsen, a Danish doctor who lived in Villahermosa. There are all sorts of correspondences between Eskildsen and the Fellows. Eskildsen writes in one of his letters that his daughter just died in Tlalpan. We learn in the novel that Captain Fellows' daughter, Coral, who helps the whiskey priest, also dies off. So there are all these kind of strange synergies and correspondences between the Power and the Glory and the historical documents. I want to give you another letter from October 1927, where Macario reports that he was staying in his old parish of Nacajuca. And he writes that how at midnight, six armed men burst into his room demanding a cash sum. They wanted 150 pesos in order to let him go. That was a huge sum at that time. That would have taken a Mexican peasant a whole year to earn that money. Macario's dilemma was that he had 500 pesos, and he writes that it was kept in a little wooden box that I take everywhere. And he had to show the police this money. The way he escaped them taking all of the money was that he pretended the box belonged to the house where the box was being stored. So he asked for a loan of some of this money so that he could pay off the police. And we get various other reports of these kinds of cases. Sometimes Macario writes that there are good people in Tabasco. After this incident, he writes that he was consoled by the fact that there are still Christian people, because on learning of the theft that was done to me, people sent me articles of clothing of varying quality from Villahermosa in greater number than I needed. But the police still got his, what he calls his petaca, his little leather suitcase, in which he carried all of the cash around with him, and they got his little wooden box. So it's very hard for readers of The Power and the Glory not to see in the little wooden box or the suitcase, the petaca, the props that would reemerge as the whiskey priest's attaché case and other accoutrements in The Power and the Glory. Green's depiction of persecution's impact on a priest's sense of self, the shedding of religious articles, honor, and prestige, is historically accurate to a T, so far as we can read from Macario's correspondence. Let me give you two more examples, one from 1928 and one from 1929. In October 1928, Macario reports that he was visited by a local official who had noticed that unusual numbers of people were coming to the house in the village where he was staying. He describes the man as the commissar of a certain village and at the same time the chief of the mounted police in Villahermosa. The man demanded money. This was a very difficult thing for Macario, because if he pays the official money, he is violating the church's requirement that he administer on church authority and not on state authority. He's basically paying a tax for the right to minister. So what did he do? Let's hear it from Macario himself. What does he say? This is the letter that Macario writes about this incident. He says, "The man came to visit me, and in the well-founded belief that he might pursue me if I did not give him something, I told him that I did not have any beer at hand to offer him, but I did give his assistant 5 pesos with which they could buy him one when they returned to Villahermosa." And 5 days later, the same kinds of requests keep happening, so more beer is obviously required. So I wonder if this report, getting the chief of police beered up, inspires the famous scene in The Power and the Glory where the whiskey priest must share his communion wine. Green, as we know, makes the scene a kind of agonizing Last Supper where all of the wine is squandered. I think it's just possible, too, that Green's mestizo, the whiskey priest Judas, is rooted in fact. In the years 1929 to 1931, Macario's letters become filled with reports that Garrido sent a priest hunter after him. In February 1929, Macario writes that the Red Shirts have sent armed men to hunt me down and kill him. They had found an individual of crude intelligence but religious ignorance who was willing to do the work and who had won Garrido's confidence by burning a religious image in Villahermosa. In January 1930, we find again, Macario writes about the same man. He says that this man was a criminal who obtained the promise of being spared a serious punishment if his brothers apprehended me. And then in December 1931, Macario reports how this half-educated individual had come through local villages looking for him. Yet in fact, the historical denouement is very different to the one in the book. Macario reports how in one hamlet, the inhabitants unmasked the individual, and instead of taking him to Macario's house, they led him off into the jungle, and he was never seen again. Many people assure me that he was killed. It can't have ended well for that man, seeing the machetes glinting down some jungle trail. The second theme of oil and wine. Consecrating wine is something that comes up again and again in The Power and the Glory, but it's not the only liquid that Macario talks about. In fact, he talks much more about holy oils. Again, there are three of them in the Catholic Church, two for baptism and one for the last rites or extreme unction. There had to be a bishop to consecrate those oils, which meant them very hard to come by in Tabasco, because they had to be consecrated in Mexico City and then sent in little glass vases and jars all the way to Tabasco. Macario needed oil a lot more than he needed wine. Wine was used in the Mass, but Mexican indigenous Catholics didn't really go that often to Mass. The wine was only consumed by the priest, but oil was used all the time to baptize everybody, and baptism was the one sacrament that everybody in Tabasco basically had. So a little wine went a long way, a lot of oil went only a short way. And these are the kinds of ceremonies that Macario is talking about. These are from Mexico State. Unfortunately, I don't have any from Tabasco, but these kind of al fresco, primitive, like religious ceremonies that were going on in clandestine settings all across Mexico. And Macario was obviously deeply involved in this kind of passive resistance to the Mexican revolutionary government. But the constant anxiety, the desperate resourcefulness, the confusion that characterized the whiskey priest's relationship with wine and the power and the glory are all expressed in Macario's letters about oil, because his ministry as a Baptist in indigenous Catholic life was so essential. Just 2 or 3 months into the worst of the persecutions, for example, Macario writes to Diaz that the oil of catechumens is running out and the chrism that I bought from Mexico City is almost gone, so much that for the last blessing with water, I had to use the old oils from the previous year. Again and again, he writes how urgent it is that he obtain new oils. This letter from February 1930, the subject comes up again. He writes that the holy oils have become very difficult for me to use because recently, traveling to a place along a road that was unknown even to my guides, we had to sleep on a lagoon, or better said, spend the night. It was raining and the canoe filled up with water so that all the vessels got wet, with the result that all the labels that say which is the oil for the sick and which are the other two oils came off. I was carrying both the oils that your illustriousness kindly sent me, and everything has been lost. So it's the constant search for oil, really, rather than wine that dominates his life. In June 1930, he writes that he has nothing left but a tiny piece of medical cotton, half saturated with oil of catechumens, enough for 5 baptisms, so long as the baptismal water consists only of holy water. So it's just a dab of the baptismal characters. We don't even get a mention of wine until 1930, so 4 years into the persecution. Whatever wine Macario had, he wasn't glugging it down as he is in The Power and the Glory. He does write letters about the wine at that point, but they're not so frequent, and they're not so desperate really until the 1930s, when we find him writing again and again to Pascual Diaz about wine and asking for wine to be sent in a hurry from Mexico City. There are all kinds of problems. People sent him prune wines and other disgusting concoctions that he can't actually consecrate and can't use. People in Villahermosa don't want to receive the wine because Tabasco is a dry state, so they send some of it back, and so on and so on. But you get the same kinds of incidences occurring. The third theme then, which will be Indigenous Catholics, and this is one of the things that Green unquestionably gets right about Mexico, the way that religious persecution complicated the relationship between Catholic priests and Indigenous people. At the time, they would have said Indian parishioners, but we wouldn't say that now. Macari himself sometimes even uses the phrase "inditos," little Indians, a very kind of paternalistic description to describe them. And the problem was this, that because persecution made priests so vulnerable, they were so hunted, it made them more dependent on the people for food, for protection, for carrying mail, and therefore they were more susceptible to the demands that people might make. And these tensions are really not part of the church's official narrative about the religious persecution. And so I'm wondering how Green had such intimate knowledge of them, if not perhaps from reading the Macario letters. As early as October 1926, again just two or three months into the worst of the persecution, he writes that he went to his old parish, Nacajuca, and was shocked to find that the indigenous patrons of religious fiestas, so all religious fiestas in Mexico are paid for by people who are called patrones or mayordomos, indigenous elders, basically, that cough up the money and put on a religious festival. The elders only wanted to pay Macario a third of what they used to pay before the persecution. Underground religion was a buyer's market. In September 1928, we have the same kind of comment. Macario writes to Diaz that nothing has made me suffer so much in this period of persecution as hearing from time to time and from the lips of Catholics comments like this one. Today you made 90 pesos in one day and by working in the shade. Some indigenous people thought Macario was a lazy friar tuck and they couldn't believe that all the money he was raising it wasn't just for him, it was for the church, and it was for educating Catholic boys in Mexico City and in New York. Another huge problem was that Macario was a virtual prisoner of his hosts, so people disturbed him whenever they liked, and he was terrified to refuse them. The thing that most embitters my solitude, he writes to Diaz in July 1929, was that he was living in shacks with only one room, so it was impossible to find quiet places where he could do his accounting, his bookkeeping, all of the other things to do. And he says, as your illustrious will comprehend, if I pay them no attention, if he pays his constant visitors no attention, then they might believe, as some have already expressed to me, that it is because they are poor. So he has to be very careful not to suggest that the church is a class-based institution when he's living with campesinos, and this is something that he struggles to do. Hell hath no fury like a spurned indigenous Catholic. But then in September 1930 came a really shocking incident at San Carlos. Macario was there, but he didn't actually see the incident, apparently, where Garrido's red shirts murdered a popular indigenous religious leader called Gabriel Garcia. They hacked him to death with machetes and threw the chunks into the river for the fishes. And after that, he writes that with very few exceptions, people turn their backs on him, and they won't allow him into their homes anymore. This is when he has to start taking advantage of that little enclave in Chiapas where he can be free of the state government of Tabasco. One of the later letters, this one's from April 1932, is straight out of The Power and the Glory. And it reminds me of that scene where the whiskey priest trembles with rage when he is unable to take the steamship to safety from the docks of Villahermosa because his services are suddenly required up country. In this letter, Macario describes a rare triumph, first of all. In the village of Reforma, which is near his bolt hole in La Ceiba, La Ceiba's a little ranch on the border of Tabasco and Chiapas, he was finally able to celebrate a public mass because the people paid off the officials or the officials turned a blind eye. But once the moment of elation had passed, Macario becomes depressed by the fact that local people start to become greedy. They ask him for money. He has to give them loans, which are hardly ever repaid, and he can't turn them down. He has to pay for an armed escort. At one point, he writes, he had to buy a rifle for his Sherpas and his bodyguards, which turns rusty in the rain. And he has to constantly reduce the fees that he's able to charge for his religious services because he needs the goodwill of indigenous people. But he understands that this is causing trouble for Diaz and for the diocese in Tabasco. The particular letter I'm talking about, in which Macario expresses all of these frustrations, was torn from his typewriter by the wind and ripped in two. And this, he tells Diaz, explains its strange dimensions. The emotions themselves were also turbulent. In his dealings with indigenous Catholics, Macario writes that a certain rage, genio, timidity and shame have seized hold of me. It's the literal experience that we find in The Whiskey Priest in the Green novel. Theme four, okay, sainthood. So it's in October 1926, as the impact of persecution becomes clear, that we start to see a kind of double archive emerging. Pascual Diaz starts to make carbon copies of all his letters to Macario. That's really unusual in Mexican archives in the 1930s. All you get is one half of the correspondence, because paper's expensive, typing, and blah, blah, blah. But Diaz begins to keep all of his own letters to Macario, which I think tells us that he was seeing that these are exceptional in some way. And reading in retrospect, it's hard not to conclude that Diaz was preparing Macario for some kind of special role, some kind of saintly elevation even. Diaz's tone becomes suddenly less patriarchal and more fatherly. He calls Macario his beloved son in Christ. He asks Macario to pray for him and to be remembered in his prayers. May God our Lord repay you for all that you have done. Keep up the fight with much prudence for the good of these poor Tabasqueños. Note how well God has chosen you to be his instrument in that difficult land. We can see that Diaz is obviously cultivating Macario for sainthood and views him as a special priest. By 1932, as I've said, Macario was hunted and shunned and he was barely hanging on. I suffer a great deal, sufro mucho, he told Diaz. Diaz's reply on this occasion compares Macario to the 16th century friars who first evangelized Mexico. And in Catholic tradition in Mexico, those people are like the 12 disciples or the Arthurian knights. They're absolute archetypes. And Diaz writes to Macario at this point, think, my beloved son, that you were carrying out, right in the 20th century, a mission similar to that which the first priests carried out in this land when they spread Christ's religion. He tells Macario to be always worthy of his priesthood. It's very interesting. In the letter, Diaz has a typo. So where he says worthy, which would be digno, he actually writes an S, which is the next door letter, which would be signo. So he's almost describing Macario as a living sign of the church in Tabasco. Final section, which I've called an unabsorbed Green, because one of my favorite quotes from the Lawless Rose is the scene where Green arrives in Tabasco with his convinced of his outsider status, and he finds that everybody else in Tabasco is called Green, because there was a family of American Greens that went to Tabasco and became very assimilated. And he writes that the prospect of being assimilated was very alarming for an unabsorbed Green. So my question is whether Green was really so unabsorbed as he would like us to believe. And in Catholic Mexico, at least, Green was really on the inside track. He was fully absorbed. So the question is, who by? So he meets various people. We hear about all these names in the Lawless Roads and in the diary. He reports meeting in March and April 1938 in lunches and tedious soirees, as he describes them, a whole group of intellectuals. The Bishop of Chiapas, which is the diocese next door to Tabasco in southern Mexico. That's basically Father Macario's line manager. He meets this man here, Leopoldo Ruiz y Flores. It's a brilliant like thumbnail description that Green comes up with. Bitter, kindly, Pickwickian. That's exactly what he was like. But he was the apostolic delegate. So Mexico and Rome didn't have diplomatic relations during the Mexican Revolution, so there had to be Mexican appointees as papal envoy in Mexico, essentially. And that was the role that Ruiz y Flores played. So this is the nearest thing you get to a pope in Mexico. And Green is meeting this man two or three times before he goes to Tabasco. Then a couple more individuals that might be worth mentioning. This one here on my left is Miguel Darío Miranda. He was the bishop of a place called Tulancingo, and Green has a brilliant description for him as well. He says he was dark, stout, and young. He reminded me a little of an Italian diplomat. To me, he looks like a lot like an Italian diplomat with the shades and the little fedora hat and everything. Miranda was the person who was given the responsibility of rebuilding the Mexican church after the religious persecution was done. He was taken out of Mexico during the Cristero War and was told to prepare for the future because there would be a day after the persecution. And Green writes in his diary and in some of the other correspondence that gets mentioned in the biographies that he met the mysterious Father Miranda in New York in January 1938, so before he even gets to Mexico, and also had corresponded with him at various points. The last figure is the mysterious Dr. C. So he talks about the historian Dr. C. Who is that? Well, that figure is Alberto Maria Carreño, the man behind me, behind my right shoulder. Who was Carreño? Who were all these people? Well, it's important to understand what they represented. In reality, Green is interacting with the moderate wing of the Mexican Catholic Church, Diaz, Luis Miranda. They were conciliators. They were the ones that had opposed the policy of outright confrontation with the Mexican Revolutionary Government and the signing of the peace deal in the 1920s. They were utterly despised by the more radical, hardcore, pro-Cristero factions in Mexico City, and they were accused of being Catholic traitors, essentially. But I think Green's literary ambivalences about Father Macario are to some extent those of this equivocating group. He immortalizes Macario, a protege of Bishop Diaz, and in his book he humanizes the image of the reluctant, flawed martyr, not the heroic Catholic, staring down the firing squad, arms outstretched, shouting, "Long live Christ the King." Dr. C, by the way, was a biographer of Pascual Diaz, Macario's bishop, and he was the organizer of the Archdiocese of Mexico's historical archive. So he was the one that had in his hands the letters from Macario, and I'm very sure that he must have showed those to Green or spoken to Green about them a lot. Green meets Carreño four times, he writes in his visit. And he says in one of his letters to his mother that the Mexican bishops are going to open their secret archives for me. I'm pretty sure that they did, and that Dr. C would have been the one that did that. Is it possible that Green met Macario? I think it is. In the novel, of course, the whiskey priest dies at the end. He dies in a routine heap in front of the firing squad. The people in Tabasco that Norman Sherry interviewed in the 1970s confirmed the story of Macario's death, but all they were really confirming was the end of the novel. They'd read it in the book, and this is what they told Sherry. In reality, Macario was alive and kicking in 1938 when Green visited Tabasco. It's very possible, perhaps even likely, that Green and Macario beheld one another in the flesh. Green had a motive. He had personal Catholicism. He was writing a novel. He knew all of the people, the top guys in the church. Was there a chance? So let's have a look at the historical facts as we know them. So this is Green's diary. He writes that he arrives in Tabasco on March the 23rd, 1938, after a disastrous voyage from Veracruz in a tub with wretch-inducing latrines. He leaves Tabasco 7 days later on March the 29th in an aeroplane to Chiapas. So he's there for 6 or 7 days in 1938. Where is Macario? Well, if we look at the different parish books and the baptismal records, we can get quite a good sense of where Father Macario was at this time as well. And they tell us a different story to the one that's in the book. They show that Macario, when he was captured, the capture's in September 1935, he's captured in a little indigenous village called Boquerón, just south of Villahermosa, 4 or 5 miles south of Villahermosa. And he's not executed, he's deported to Guatemala. And we see him practicing his ministry in Guatemala. I've got a note here that the first baptism was on December 15, 1935, and the last one was on June 16, 1937. We then lose sight of him until January 1938, which is the month that Green arrives in New York, when Macario suddenly reappears in Villahermosa, baptizing again. By March, we know that he was in a place called Ermita Playas del Rosario, so the hermitage called the Rosary shoreline, basically. And if you look on a map, that place is 5 or 6 miles south of Villahermosa. On 9th of March, 1938, just to give you one example, he baptizes 190 people. So if you scale that up, 190 people plus two parents plus two godparents, You've got about 1,000 people going to that rancho to see Father Macario on one day. So everybody knew that he was there. Everybody. Just two or three hours walk, or ride in a boat, or a ride on a horse from Villahermosa. So for Green not to have met Macario, we have to assume that he never asked anybody in Tabasco, is Macario alive? Is Macario here? Where might he be? Or that he let such a trifling distance stop him. That's as close as I can get, really, without tormenting the text of the Lawless Roads. Is there any evidence that Green and Macario's paths converged? Well, perhaps in the Lawless Roads and in his diary, where Green tells of his three visits in Villahermosa to see an elderly Scotsman, Dr. Roberto Fitzpatrick, who he says showed him a vellum-bound book written by his father. Fitzpatrick Sr. supposedly trekked from Tabasco to Panama in the 1860s, and there he met a bizarre and drunken priest, the disreputable and kindly Father Rey. It was Fitzpatrick, Green writes, who told him about Macario, the drunken priest. He's just what we call a whiskey priest. I'm not going to do a Scottish accent like Kevin tried. A poor man, a kind of Padre Rey. And Green writes that the Lord alone should judge such flawed priests. But to me, anyway, it's a bit far-fetched that an English writer would travel to Tabasco to write a book about a peripatetic whiskey priest who was exiled to Central America, Macario, only to be shown a book written by an Anglo-Scot telling him the story of a peripatetic whiskey priest who went to Central America 70 years earlier. That seems strange to me. I think Green is alluding perhaps to a visit to Macario and inserting him as a cutout in a book inside a book. Let me end by describing Macario's actual martyrdom, which was banishment. So this is 10 years after Green has left Tabasco. In 1947, Macario was fired by his new bishop, a man called Bishop del Valle, and expelled from the diocese of Tabasco. Del Valle writes that he expels Macario because of his alcoholism and his political intriguing. Macario was the leader of a clerical mafia that refused to take orders from a new incoming bishop. Macario felt scorned because they have not made him Bishop of Tabasco. And he's given a terrible example as a drunk in the whole state for 30 years. So these are the reasons that Del Valle suggests. Macario is not powerless. Somehow, he gets the papal visitor to Mexico to write a letter to Del Valle, basically instructing him to take him back and to open his paternal arms wide to his errant priest. But Del Valle never does that. We have to read through the correspondence all the way to the end to really find out why his bishop defied the papal visitor. And really, it seems that Macario's true crime was that he criticized the way that the religious persecution was being remembered in Mexico, it was being monumentalized and written into history. In 1944, Del Valle imported a religious image to Tabasco, an image of the divine prisoner, an image of Christ in bondage that in local parlance is called El Señor de Tabasco, the Lord of Tabasco. Del Valle had the icon ferried by river to Villahermosa in time for Easter, and it was said that the image appeared in Tabasco, signifying the church's miraculous escape from revolutionary bondage. This was too much for Macario, who'd really been the lifeblood of the Catholic Church in Tabasco during the persecution. And he went about telling people, the Lord of Tabasco is no apparition. So really his sin was to criticize the political the makeover that was being given to the persecution in Tabasco in later years. Just to finish, in September 1951, we know that Macario died in Mexico State, age 67, without being allowed to retire to Guadalajara and to live with his two brothers. That was his last request. Release me from my vow of obedience and allow me to go and spend my last days with my brothers in Guadalajara. He was never allowed to do that, and he died in the town of Zacualpan in Mexico State in September 1951. I think it was a vindictive and shabby way to treat someone who for a decade had been the church's only real face in Tabasco. But before he died, I can more happily report Macario wrote that he'd been sober for many years. Thank you.
Matthew, I think I'm not the only person here who's quite astounded at what you've just told us. This is amazing material, and I'm sure there are lots of questions. Can I just start with one? Can you tell us a bit more about the mestizo? Because I had always assumed with Sherry that he was a typist whose hand Sherry shook, and I just sort of took that at face value. Maybe bits of that person were transferred to the character, but this is the story?
I think it's a possible story. So, I mean, I don't know for sure that Green read the letters, but the similarities are so close at so many points that I just think he must have looked at this material. The mestizo is one of the most controversial characters, like in The Power and the Glory, because of the way that the Judas is racialized. So it may not be the case, but you know, there were pursuivants. They had some of the attributes of the mestizo. They came after him. Macario is jailed. He meets government spies all the time. So I think the character I described, or the historical figure I described, is the most likely. I would put it no more than that, but I think it's a suggestive parallel for sure.
Hi there. Thank you very much for a very perceptive discussion here on the role of Mexico, sort of in the 1930s. One thing I was a bit interested in that you said. You mentioned that. This is The Power and the Glory is almost sort of a Mexican 39 Steps, and well, I'm particularly interested in the fact how Green adopts these genre conventions, you know, the thriller genre for his most serious novels, especially when he's doing drugs and writing The Confidential Agent in the Morning, while he's working on The Power and the Glory. But that's not my question, actually. What I was wanted to ask you is that we're all aware that Green is somehow prophetic of things come in the future, the Quiet American, or the Cuban Missile Crisis, and Our Man in Havana. And what are sort of your opinions on what Green may have thought or may have been beginning to think about liberation theology in Mexico, which does quite take over, maybe 20, 30 years later, of the communism, Catholicism?
Yeah. That's an interesting question. I mean, I would have, you know, liberation theology is a 1960s phenom, essentially. He would have been in the right place. So Chiapas in Mexico is the diocese that's most associated with liberation theology. There was a bishop there called Samuel Ruiz. In official accounts by the Mexican government, the one-party government, he was called the Red Bishop because he was always like mobilizing indigenous people. And in fact, Ruiz and liberation theology are considered like tributaries in the Zapatista rebellion in Chiapas in the 1990s. So Green would have been in absolutely the right place. But he was there at the wrong time. I think the interesting thing about Green's Catholicism, about religious history in Mexico, is the way that Green is critical of that kind of Pope-centric, hardcore, like militant Catholicism, and sympathetic to a figure such as the Whiskey Priest, and sympathetic to indigenous Catholics. So he's a critical Catholic. And those were the kinds of people that get involved in liberation theology. Did Green have an interest in liberation theology? I have no idea. I do not know. I suspect not. I mean, his views about like the religious violence in Mexico and the possibilities for success were pretty cynical. In The Power and the Glory, we have the figure of Luis, the little boy who gets read like the martyr stories and the Cristera tales. And at one point he like bangs the table while his mother's reading them and says, nobody could be such a fool. nobody could think that you could have a revolutionary style Catholicism or a Catholicism of such powerful sentiments that would be politically effective. So I hope that's an answer to your question.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for such an enlightening presentation. I wanted to say something about Lucas here was saying. It's Green wrote an introduction to a book, Church and Politics in Latin America, in 1990, if I'm not mistaken. And he said in that introduction that he saw the beginning of the liberation theology movement in the communities, the base communities there. So like, you know, he could see somehow like the beginnings of all the later theoretical movement. Apart from that, like, I had a question for you. It's like, you know, in post-colonial criticism, you know, Green has been accused of, you know, like having like an Eurocentric view and depicting like, you know, countries such as Mexico and the power and the glory. I mean, they even say it's a Mexico of cardboard, you know, some critics and the hot passions and stuff like that. So like, I totally disagree because like when you compare the power and the glory, for example, with Juan Rulfo's Pedro Páramo, I mean, you can see like, you know, uncanny similarities, like for example, in the depiction of the church, you know, before the revolution. So like, I'm guessing what your answer is gonna be, but like, I mean, do you think like Mexico is really like a region of the mind, of the author's mind? In this case, as many critics, you know, would say.
Is Mexico a region of the mind for Green? I think Green went to a place, a real place. He went to Tabasco. He didn't go to Jalisco. He didn't go to Michoacán. He didn't go to places where Catholicism has this like tremendous thudding power and this like enormous presence. He went to somewhere where the church was weak and broken and vulnerable. And I think he poeticized that in a really extraordinary way. That surprises me, like reading through these letters, that the novel is such a historical novel. And I suspect that it was based on this real exploration of the Whiskey Priest letters. So I find it a very intimate and very compelling portrait of his time in Tabasco. To me, it feels true to life. It feels true to life about indigenous Mexico and other places. I think it's a very accurate portrayal of the church in Tabasco. About the politics, I mean, I think, again, I don't know about liberation theology. Like, liberation theology implies like a huge like conceptual leap to the idea of enculturation, that we don't take God to people, we find God in people. So had Green made that like conceptual shift? I don't know, but he was certainly very opposed to, you know, militant, Pope-centric, hardcore Cristero Catholicism, and that comes across very, very strongly in all of his writings. That's the supply line to liberation theology, sympathy to indigenous people, looking for evidence of a deeper kind of devotion in indigenous people. He finds that when he goes to the Basilica of Guadalupe and he sees the indigenous people kneeling down with their arms outstretched. I mean, that to him is the crucifixion, not a Cristero martyr sticking their arms out. And he says that those people remind him of the stigmata. So that they are literally Christ-like people. So he's getting there like intuitively, poetically, bit by bit. And if he'd carried on that journey, then he probably would have got there. And it seems to me from your opening comment about the book that maybe he did get it in the end. I will track that down and have a look and see.
Since I have the microphone, can I ask a question? thank you very much. This is so fascinating. This was one of the main reasons I wanted to come to hear this, because this was very new, productive knowledge. Was there any sense, since the Whiskey Priest is a kind of an amalgamation of these Miguel Pro and this man, did this man know Miguel Pro? Is there anything in the letters that says that Miguel Pro was part of his own imaginative way of being the priest or being this kind of man?
I don't recall reading about Pro in any way in Macario's letters. He's talking to Diaz, and we have to remember that Pascual Diaz, although he's a Jesuit like Miguel Pro, he's not your typical Jesuit. He is the one who signs the peace deal with the Mexican Revolutionary Government in 1929. He is hated for that beyond belief. There are Cristeros, or Catholic kind of guerrilla fighters, who plot to murder Pascual Diaz for that. So it's an incredibly contentious kind of decision that's made. And Macario's relationship with Diaz is very much in the, you know, one of these spiritual correspondences between a priest and a bishop, sometimes it's between a priest and a layperson, where you feel that Macario is the spiritual progeny of Diaz. He admires him, he writes to him. So I think Diaz is coaching Macario about his priesthood all the way through. I didn't have time to talk about all of the letters where Diaz describes him as a virtual martyr, but Diaz begs him not to leave Tabasco. Like, it's so unusual for a bishop to beg a priest in Mexico to do something at that time. It's like the king begging a subject to do something. It's a very unusual situation. So I think Macario's concept of priesthood is framed by his relationship with Diaz, especially, and by his experience of ministry amongst indigenous people more than anything. One of my favorite scenes in The Power and the Glory is at the end when, is it Luis, the little boy, he's looking out of the window at the yard where the execution's about to take place, and the whiskey priest is led out, and Green has fun with the legacy of Pro almost. It sounds perverse to say that, but he says the whiskey priest is trying to do something with his arms. He's trying to put them out and be the crucifix, but he can't manage it. Like, he doesn't have the strength. And I don't think he has the intellectual or the spiritual stuff that's required to do that, because he's a different kind of priest.
We've gone a little over time, but this is just so fascinating. I'm sure that there'll be many further questions in almost right away for Matthew on this subject. So why not head over to the King's Arms? We don't want the pizza to get cold. Thank you.